May it please the court, Tom Briggs of Morris Nichols Arshton Tunnel, on behalf of Enbridge Energy Company. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Kevin Logue of Paul Hastings.
Welcome to the court.
With the court's permission, Mr. Logue will be making the argument today on behalf of our clients.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, Raymond D. Camillo from Richards, Layton & Finger for Enbridge, Inc., Enbridge Employee Services, and certain of the individual defendants. I'd like to introduce my colleague seated with me at council table, Michael Steinberg from Sullivan & Cromwell in Los Angeles.
Welcome to the court.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jessica Zeldin from Rosenthal Monheit on behalf of Plaintiff Brinkerhoff. I rise this morning to introduce my co-counsel with me at council table as Mr. Lawrence Eagle and Mr. Jeffrey Squire. Mr. Eagle will be making today's argument on behalf of plaintiff.
Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Morning.
As you're approaching the podium, let me tell you about our clock. When I start the clock, it will be your total of 20 minutes, and the green light will be on. I understand that you'd like to reserve 5. The yellow light will come on when you have 5 minutes left. You can continue speaking, but you'll be using the time you've reserved.
Thank you. May it please the court, Your Honors, Lawrence Eagle, counsel to the plaintiff in this matter. The court below committed 3 errors. The court below said the complaint did not plead bad faith. It did. The court below said that the investment and banker's opinion was conclusive of the general partner's good faith. It wasn't. And third, the court said the exculpation clause ends the case. It didn't. The court did not consider the claim for reformation. I'm going to address each of these points in order. First, on the issue of bad faith. This was a highly valuable pipeline project that provided a significant opportunity to the partnership. The pipeline had been under consideration for over 2 years. It had the partnership had obtained permits. The partnership had spent $150 million. The partnership was ready to go. The pipeline connects Enbridge Corp, the parent's pipeline system in Canada, to U.S. pipelines throughout the United States, specifically in the Midwest. At the time, the partnership had already projected revenues of $170 million, revenue, EBITDA of $170 million. These were not arbitrary numbers. These were numbers this partnership released to the public in February of 2009. So they were assured numbers. They weren't, and the pipeline business is such that these, all that was necessary at this point was build the pipeline, turn the spigot on. Canadian tar sands had a tremendous volume of oil that needed to come into the United States. This was a valuable project for the partnership. In January of 2009, Enbridge Corp comes to the partnership and says, we'll finance your project, and we'll do it at cost. No investment is done at cost for a business that's been operating for 2 years. That's the first problem. The second problem is cost with $170 million at EBITDA amounts to a price that's $560 million less than a fair price. The $560 million is not a pie-in-the-sky number or a number that's arbitrary. It's based on EBITDA multiples that the investment banker used that are published on the investment banker's website. These were solid numbers. In fact, similar numbers are referenced in the Vice Chancellor Laster's decision in TEPCO, in which pipeline projects are ordinarily at the multiples we've described. So the price was $560 million below a fair price. The special Enbridge, the partnerships.
Is that a quarrel with the methodology of the banker?
That is not a quarrel with the methodology of the banker. That is purely a determination of price. The methodology of the bankers, it does not involve a quarrel with the methodology of the banker. It is contrary to the banker's decision, or it affects the determination ultimately of whether this is a fair price. And the court below did not consider whether this was a fair price in its analysis of whether the defendants had acted in bad faith. The court glossed over, in fact, assumed that it was that the price was unfair, said even if the price was unfair, The court turns its attention to the exculpation clause. But the price being $560 million too low is a significant fact in determining whether or not the defendants acted in good faith. They didn't. The process, so that's the price. Let's talk about the process for a minute. Because
well, before you do that, just so it will be clear, in my mind, the $526 million price, or that is the price that was too low by that amount,
correct,
is based on the difference between multiplying some number, some EBITDA number by 9 less that same number by 7, right?
That's correct. It's actually multiplying the number by 12 as compared to the number by 7, because 12 was the number that is used in pipeline projects that are contributed to MLPs according to Tudor's website, the investment banker's website. Mm-hmm. If you use the 9 times multiple and compare that multiple to the 7 times multiple, the damage or the price was $200 million.
So you're saying that it was as possibly as high as or as low as $526 million.
Correct, but at least
based on that metric.
Correct, but at least $200 million, and the 9 times multiple was the multiple that was on the investment banker's website and was in every example that that the investment banker presented to the special committee.
Is the investment banker's opinion in the record in some form?
The investment banker's opinion, only the specific opinion itself, in which the investment banker says that the conclusion that the terms of the transaction are representative of an arm's length transaction, and that's in the complaint.
Just the conclusion, but not the opinion letter itself.
Correct.
Well, let's go into the issue of good faith. As I understand it, you seem to be arguing that they should have rejected the expert's opinion. Now, in the vice chancellor's opinion, he said, clearly the standard is try to replicate something that you could get at arm's length. And in this case, the vice chancellor acknowledges you didn't check with any third parties. You didn't do a market check. You basically came to a proportionate capital contribution, but that's what experts do. And although it talks about arm's length replication, it was all right for the committee, the independent committee, to rely on the expert's report. So tell us why they didn't accept the expert's report in good faith, and why where the vice chancellor was wrong in simply saying it was a qualified expert, even though he didn't get there by talking to third parties or doing a market check. He got there, and they could rely in good faith on the report.
The vice chancellor was wrong because the partnership agreement requires that the terms of any transaction, any conflicted transaction, and this is the quintessential conflicted transaction. The general partner, in this case, is owned by Enbridge. The general partner causes the partnership to sell partnership assets to the general partner. So
that's authorized by the agreement itself, isn't it?
Well, and that's what I was just going to describe. It's only authorized by the agreement if the terms are fair and reasonable. Certainly they can do it. They can only do it, however, if the terms of the transaction are fair and reasonable to the partnership. That's the condition. Certainly Delaware allows for contracting parties to define the terms under which a conflicted sale can occur, but when it does that, the partnership must comply with the terms specifically. In fact, in the recent case, Gatz case by Chancellor Strine, he analyzed a similar provision and found that was akin to had some fairness or entire fairness analysis that was certainly at least as it related to the price. So the fair and reasonable standard means it was the reason why this special committee could not accept this banker's report.
But tell me how they got there. I mean, that's the purpose of my earlier question. You're saying they didn't act in good faith in relying on this expert's report. And my question is, finish the sentence, because
they did not insist that the investment banker provide an opinion that was required by the terms of the partnership agreement. They did not insist that the banker provide them with an opinion that the terms of the transaction were fair from a financial point of view, which bankers do all the time. They didn't insist that the banker render an opinion that the terms were no less favorable than those generally available from or provided by unrelated third parties, which is the provision that partnership agreement requires to satisfy. satisfy the fair and reasonable requirement. The special committee had did, and in the documents that have been produced as alleged in the complaint, there's no explanation why the special committee did not insist on both either a fairness opinion or an opinion that met the standard in the partnership agreement. The only conclusion one can draw is that the banker wouldn't provide that opinion. It certainly raises a question as to why, if it was easy enough, fair and reasonable is a standard that bankers could, fairness opinions bankers give all the time. That's a standard that these members of the special committee, having been advised by experienced lawyers and considering what should the terms of the, what do we need from our banker? What we need is a fairness from our opinion from our banker. This is a conflicted transaction in which we're concerned that somebody's going to second guess the judgment as to whether or not this price is fair. There's been no price negotiations. We're doing a sale at cost. Get a fairness opinion. Insist on that.
In the fairness standard that's enshrined in the partnership agreement, I gather you're arguing that that imports something akin to the entire, the at least the financial side of the entire fairness standard in fiduciary land. Is that right?
I think that's right. It is.
The entire fairness standard basically uses as a hallmark what the result would have been were this an arm's-length transaction, correct?
Correct.
All right. Isn't that, in essence, what the opinion of the Tudor company stated, even though it may not have been as artful as one might have liked?
No, not at all.
Why not?
Because the opinion used the term representative of an arm's-length transaction, which is totally different than whether or not this is an arm's-length transaction. The term representative of an arm's-length transaction is not the same as fair from a financial point of view.
Certainly verbally it's not, but why should that not be attributed just to unfortunate wording or inartful wording as opposed to some deliberate attempt to make this opinion look like a fairness opinion when it really was something else? I mean, what was it that should have put the committee on notice such that by not reacting to the actual words of that opinion, the committee is now charged or must be chargeable with having acted in bad faith?
Well, I think Your Honor's question, first, this is an opinion we could not find anywhere else, and we've said that twice for the and the defendants so far haven't advised us of any time in which another investment banker has given the same opinion. But more importantly, we're at the pleading stage. And so I don't ask the court to decide today that we're going to win, though I believe we may. That isn't the question. The question today is, have we raised an issue for the court to look further? Is the court not interested why they rendered this decision? I certainly am interested as to why they gave an opinion when a fairness opinion is traditional. It's not uncommon to say the material terms of this transaction are fair, and it's not.
Well, is that the standard? Is the court interested? Isn't the standard for the sufficiency of the pleading something different?
No, the standard for the sufficiency of the pleading is have we raised an issue as to whether or not the terms of this transaction were fair and reasonable? And I believe the absence of a fairness opinion, the absence of an opinion that comports with the terms of the partnership agreement, those two things, coupled with other factors, I don't only rely on that factor. I believe it's an important factor. I believe the price is an important factor. I believe the fact that there's the absence of any price negotiations at all.
Okay, Enbridge, we're talking about the opinion.
Okay. I guess the
opinion said, rather than representative of an arm's length transaction, if it used the term equivalent to the outcome of an arm's length transaction, would that have satisfied the plaintiffs? Would that have been adequate?
No, I think the only opinion that would have, in these circumstances, that doesn't raise a question that supports the potential for the argument of possible bad faith under these circumstances, is an opinion that says the terms of the transaction are fair, from a financial point of view, or the terms are the same as the terms generally provided by or available from unrelated third parties.
In hyc verba. Right.
In hyc verba. There is no reason why this opinion could not say in hyc verba exactly what the partnership agreement says. Why these are sophisticated bankers who they are sophisticated counsel involved representing the committee. They could have insisted on that opinion, and there is no reason other than that for some reason the banker wouldn't give that opinion.
So your position is, at the pleading stage, that you've been able to demonstrate in your complaint that there was a standard in the agreement that called for a particular type of opinion, and the opinion that was rendered was inconsistent with that standard.
That's
therefore, that raises enough for you to get to go forward.
That and the other factors I'd like to move into when the court's ready. I think that it is not only that fact. It is the fact that we have shown that the price is between $200 million and $500 million, $560 million too low. We have shown that there was no bargaining about price. We've shown, pled, and I believe it's not even disputed, that this was a deal done at cost.
Well, part of these other factors presupposes that the special committee knew all this.
They knew it was at cost.
Or at least were on a constructive notice that the deal that was agreed to or approved was anywhere from $200 to $500 million too low. Is that your claim?
That's my claim, and knew certainly should have known there was public information concerning pipeline projects. But more importantly, they knew that it was at cost. They knew that they hadn't asked for a price increase. They knew that they didn't ask for a valuation. I think in addition to the opinion itself, we have identified in the complaint the fact that there was no valuation. Now, if you're a special committee...
When you're saying a price increase, you mean requiring the general partner to contribute more capital for the same interest?
Correct. Correct. That's the traditional price negotiation. In this transaction, Enbridge said we'll spend $900 million for three quarters, and it ultimately invested $800 for two thirds.
Since we're encroaching on your rebuttal time, I do have one more question, and that is your last argument. You're saying that even if the court was absolutely right. In all respects, the exculpation clause still doesn't dispose of the case.
Correct.
And the because would be what? Because of the rescission and reformation claims?
Correct. Because of the reformation claims under these circumstances in which there's a contractually defined fiduciary duty,
The court never addressed that.
That's correct.
What presentation was made to the court?
Well, the presentation that was made was pled in the complaint, and the court made reference to it in its opinion that we had alleged that. So, it
was it argued in the briefs?
It was as we point out in our appeal reply brief, is it was first raised by the defendants in a footnote. They raised section 6.8A in a footnote in their opening brief, and in opposition, we provided the court with a footnote that said, the defendants haven't argued section 6.8A, the exculpation clause. It's an affirmative defense. But if they do press that argument, we want the opportunity for reply. We never got. I'm going to reserve. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Good morning.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Kevin Logue again. I represent the general partner and the partnership-related entities, including the independent directors. My colleague will address the reformation and the economic underpinnings of the transaction. I really want to focus on three principal points, Your Honor, and fundamentally, I want to emphasize at the outset, this is a contract case. This is not a fiduciary duty case. We're dealing with a partnership, not a corporation. There is an agreement that sets forth the rights, the duties, the remedies of the parties.
Let's start there
absolutely.
With where we left off. If it's a contract case and the contract calls for a certain type of evaluation, why shouldn't the expert's opinion track the standard in the contract?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the contract does not require an opinion. That's a phrase that plaintiff's counsel has used, but there is no opinion required.
I don't want you to get bogged down.
Fair enough.
They didn't need to get an opinion, but they did.
Fair enough.
To the extent they asked for an opinion, why shouldn't the opinion track the provisions of the contract if this is a contract case?
We believe, Your Honor, in essence, that it does. There's a safe harbor provision in the related party approval provision. That's the provision that they keep talking about that says you can approve a transaction if it's fair and reasonable. But it says, provided, however, that a transaction is deemed to be fair and reasonable if it's on terms that are generally available to third parties. Here, they got an opinion that said this is representative of an arm's-length transaction. And we have pointed out to the court that there are a number of judicial definitions of arm's-length that mean fair and reasonable, available to third parties, independent third parties, et cetera.
Yeah, but aren't you arguing that the language that was actually used in the opinion, which is different from the standards set forth in the contract, are identical or equivalent as a matter of law? Don't we have to hold that?
Well, I think they are equivalent as a matter of law, Your Honor.
These are
both as a matter of law and as a matter of common language. You know, the terms are synonymous, and
well,
indeed,
that's the issue.
Well, indeed, Your Honor, plaintiff's own complaint makes this point. They say in their complaint at paragraph 3. They accuse Enbridge, the parent corporation, of not paying a fair price that reflected arm's-length bargaining. Their own complaint acknowledges that arm's-length was the issue here.
But their argument is that the opinion that was obtained has to use in hic verba the same language as the contract. That's their argument.
I should make it clear to the court, the committee actually made a determination that followed the exact language in the related party standard. They used the third party. The board minutes reflect the conclusion that it was on terms generally available to a third party. They based that on the opinion. Again, there's no requirement that an opinion be offered, and this sort of gets to the third point. I've skipped.
There is no requirement, but they did, and then they proceeded to rely on that opinion as conclusive of good faith.
For the conclusive presumption.
I don't think it adds anything to say they weren't required to do that.
Well, except that it gets to this point, Your Honor. This case doesn't have to rest on the conclusive presumption. We believe that Vice Chancellor Noble correctly concluded that the general partner was entitled to the conclusive presumption, and that effectively does end the case. But even if one concluded that because of the difference in language, the conclusive presumption did not kick in, remember, to get money damages, and that's the issue that I'm addressing, they have to demonstrate bad faith. Now, here we have a track record. I mean, we have a fact pattern that shows what did the general partner do when they were confronted with this opportunity. They formed an independent committee. There has been no effective challenge to the three committee members. Vice Chancellor Noble says several times that the committee was independent. And so they formed an independent committee. The committee went out and got independent advisors. There's been absolutely no allegation that either the law firm they retained, the Bracewell firm, or Tudor Pickering as a banker was conflicted in any way. Tudor Pickering is their expertise is the energy sector. They're a Houston-based bank. There is no allegation that anyone should have, you know, had any concerns that the opinion was not within the competence of that expert.
Well, as I understand the other side's argument, the purported failure to insist that the opinion be rendered in compliance with the agreement allows an inference of bad faith.
Well, Your Honor, I think that is the type of strained allegation that the court need not accept on a motion to dismiss. You know, again, given the obvious similarity between arm's length and both fair and reasonable and the same terms that would be available, generally available. And by the way, it says generally available, not, you know, available to, in every instance. Given that obvious similarity that has been recognized both by the courts and by the plaintiffs in their complaint, I think it would be quite a stretch to say that was bad faith.
Well, Mr. Lugg, putting the opinion to one side then.
Yes.
Granting the independence of the members of the special committee and their advisors, there's still the argument that there was evidence out there within the actual, or at least the constructive, if not actual, knowledge of the committee members, that the price being paid by Enbridge was anywhere from $200 to $500 million too low.
Well, as Your Honor pointed out before, they're basing that argument on using multiples that they're pulling out of websites. And obviously, here a banker advised the committee, given its review of those various transactions and its own independent knowledge, that this this transaction was indeed representative of arm's length. But Your Honor also made the other point. There's no evidence at all that the committee should have understood that these arguments or known about these the specifics of these other transactions. Here again, the committee met frequently, as Vice Chancellor Noble noted. It got
advice.
When you
say no evidence, you mean no well-pled allegations?
No well-pled allegations. That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah. But what they have pled in their complaint, what they have acknowledged, is that there were frequent meetings, there were presentations made by Tudor Pickering to the committee. They've picked and chosen aspects of those to rely on. The committee got advice. The committee did negotiate, perhaps not in the way that they would have liked, but there were negotiations on various issues. So, Your Honor, even if you credited their allegations, the most you could come up with would be a gross negligence type claim. We're not conceding that that occurs, but that's the most.
Getting to this 102B7 provision, I was just looking at the Vice Chancellor's opinion, and this was a motion to dismiss. You never came forward with the charter provision and converted it to summary judgment, did you?
We raised it on the motion in response to the motion to dismiss. We basically made the argument that Vice Chancellor Noble relied on, which is they have not pled a non-exculpable claim. Here we believe, first of all, that based on the language of the contract, it is their burden to show the breach. But even if you use the sort of rationale that occurs in the corporate context, even there where it's considered an affirmative defense, courts frequently look at complaints to determine whether a non-exculpable claim has been pled. And a classic example is, a complaint where the court says, even if you prove everything you've alleged, this is at most gross negligence, and that's exculpated in the corporate context. Here it's exculpated as well. And by the way, Your Honor, they rely on the recent Gatz case. There are many distinctions between this case and Gatz. One of them is just that. In Gatz, there was an exception to exculpation for gross negligence. We don't have that here. They must prove bad faith, and they must allege it. Here, we have a waiver of fiduciary duties. We have a waiver of any duties outside the contract, including any duties under any applicable law, regulation, the Delaware Act, et cetera. We have the reliance on opinion language that Gatz didn't have. And we don't have the bad faith allegations they haven't had.
Reformation claim.
Well, Your Honor, my colleague is going to address that. I'll be happy to respond.
No, I'll wait.
I did want to make one other point, Your Honor. They raise an issue in their reply brief for the first time. They try to argue that the opinion was obtained by the special committee, and therefore only the special committee could rely on it, not the general partner. First of all, this is, again, inconsistent with the allegations in their complaint. They do allege in the complaint in paragraph 97 that the committee and the general partner relied on the opinion. They, of course, challenged the reliance, but nonetheless, they seem to have conceded it there. And this is also an issue that was recently taken up by Vice Chancellor Noble in another case, the Gerber case, where he said it would be unreasonable even on a motion to dismiss for the court to infer that although an independent subset of the board relied upon a fairness opinion, the entity that the board manages did not rely upon that opinion. I mean, it is sort of an illogical argument and frankly one that sets the wrong policy, I think. Here the board did the right thing, got a committee.
You're saying it would have made no sense for the board to put this special committee in place if it could not impute whatever reliance the special committee had to the whole board.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And indeed, the ultimate resolutions of the partnership, when they approved the recommendation, did allude to the advice that the committee had received. So that's exactly right, Your Honor. The only other thing I think I wanted to address, Your Honor, is that there is also an important. They've also made the argument. Vice Chancellor Noble noted in his opinion that the conclusive presumption language only applied to the partnership, but he speculated that there might be situations where he could not. He could envision an argument that the other defendants could say, if the general partner is not liable, then we can't be liable either. But he went on to say he didn't need to find that because he saw no allegations of bad faith. I just wanted to point out that this is an argument that actually Vice Chancellor Strine had then Vice Chancellor Strine had dealt with in Gotham Partners years ago, where he said basically the directors cannot be held liable for breach of fiduciary duty in a situation where the general partner, because of its compliance with a contractual safe harbor, does not owe such duty. Here there's no allegations, for example, of any independent personal receipt of an improper benefit by a director. Their duties, if any, were only derivative of those of the general partner, and it's quite clear that if the general partner is off, then so is everyone else. I'll defer to co-counsel now.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Michael Steinberg on behalf of the remaining defendants. I want to address two things in my argument today. First, I want to discuss the economic backdrop that was the basis for the Chancery Court determination that the special committee and the other members involved in approving the transaction were acting in good faith. Second, I'll address questions related to reformation and the availability of that remedy, particularly on this record. Unfortunately, the corrected amended complaint here challenges the conduct of the general partners and the others involved entirely through the lens of hindsight in a very troubled economic time. And so the presentation that is being made to you was entirely divorced from the economic reality that this nation found itself in the latter half of 2008 and continuing through the first half of 2009. When there was great tumult in all of the capital markets and tumult and difficulties in valuation.
Well, all of that goes to whether or not it was prudent for the partnership to take on an additional investor to share the risk. That's not really challenged here, is it? I thought only the terms.
No, I think they've challenged the entire environment, and part of because they've challenged the financing, the ability to finance the partnership independent of Enbridge. And so they suggest that the partnership should have gone out and either funded it entirely on its own or secondarily looked for private equity or others to provide.
They may suggest that, but is that a claim before us?
Yes. I mean, it was the argument below that to show the basis of bad faith that there were other options available. It is the basis of part of the criticism of the Tudor opinion that Tudor didn't perform a market check. All of the issues that we talk about get sort of sorted through that Tudor opinion.
What was the charge to the independent committee here? What was their job?
Well, the allegation was to evaluate the transaction and to make a recommendation.
And to negotiate. Right?
And to negotiate, of course. And that, in fact, happened here. They had their own counsel, their own legal counsel, their own advisors. They evaluated what was present in the market. And based upon the advice of Tudor, they determined that the way in which was best for the partnership was to accept this financing and not bear the risk itself. Now, there's
is there a basis to infer constructive notice of these other multiples?
Well, certainly there is an allegation in the complaint that Tudor considered other comparable transactions. Plaintiffs just dispute that they were in fact comparable. So there were other transactions that were considered by Tudor as part of its analysis. But in the complaint, there is much made of all of the ways in which one must distinguish those and therefore criticize the Tudor opinion and therefore transplant that to a criticism of reliance by the special committee and ultimately the general partner.
Well, and when they suggest to us that this transaction was short $580 million, in part, they rely on the 12 multiplier that's on the Tudor website, don't they?
Certainly, and that's the great misstatement in this case, Your Honor, because let's assume the $160 million as EBITDA was certainly a part of the projections. There's no doubt about that. But EBITDA is before debt, interest, and amortization. We're talking about a $1.2 billion deal in the scope during the midst of the financial crisis, when the evidence put forward in the complaint shows that there was no financing of that magnitude available except at extraordinary prices. Merrill Lynch, which offers a post-transaction criticism of the transaction, itself says that they thought there would be a blended cost of capital of 10%.
Well, Mr. Steinberg, I think we understand that there may be a claim that this partnership should not have taken on another partner or another joint venture, given the chaotic. Given the chaotic financial environment, given the all of those circumstances. Even so, I don't recall anything in Vice Chancellor Noble's opinion that even addressed that claim.
Well, he addressed that this was at the nadir of the financial crisis that the...
Yeah, he addressed it factually, but
yes.
I don't understand that even Vice Chancellor Noble understood that there was a claim for relief stated in those terms. So I guess the question is, why are you devoting so much of your time to this?
Devoting time to it because that was the part of the criticism of the Tudor opinion was either A, there was not a market check, B, the multiples, this issue of multiples, and C, the availability of capital. The allegation is that by July of 2009, when this transaction was announced, the capital markets had unfrozen. And if I may go back to the EBITDA issue, again, at a 10% blended cost of capital over $1.2 billion, that's $120 million without paying a nickel's worth, paying down the note.
Well, Mr. Steinberg, at the risk of redirecting you, you have 2.5 minutes left, and it's our understanding you're going to talk to us about reformation.
I will talk to you about reformation. It was not raised below. It was not pursued below as an argument, and it is inapplicable in a case like this, which is a contract-based case. Reformation, which would only be available if they are successful in the causes of action, reformation would only allow in a contract there to be a match between the party's expectations and the words of the agreement. There is no allegation of mismatch that this deal was not documented in the way in which the parties believed themselves. And the only way in which they can get to a equitable reformation would be based upon the existence of fiduciary duties that the limited partnership agreement had expressly disclaimed. So it's no surprise that they didn't raise it below, but had they raised it below, it would have been a very short shrift because the necessary elements are simply not there. And if I may address the Tudor opinion for just 1 minute. I mean,
well,
the,
before you do that,
yes.
There's also rescission.
Rescission is even less in the record as below. It was only a line that they sought it in their complaint. There is nothing in their briefs below on rescission, and there is nothing really in their opening brief here that raises rescission. What they raised was reformation. We identified that we were troubled by the raising of the argument at all because it had not been litigated in front of the vice chancellor and therefore should not have been raised before this court on appeal.
Okay, so your argument as to rescission is that claim, if there is such a claim, was waived.
Yes.
The argument as to reformation is that it wasn't, that it was also waived, but even if it wasn't, it wouldn't be appropriate.
Correct.
How do we deal with the fact that the vice chancellor never addressed either of these claims in his opinion?
They only come into existence if a cause of action is determined, right? A remedy doesn't exist in the abstract before a claim is asserted. It is only the question of that remedy, and that remedy is not available.
Well, Vice Chancellor's opinion did note that those two remedies were being sought, and then there was no further discussion of the opinion. There was no footnote that said, and by the way, these claims haven't been pursued, so I deem them waived. So they're sort of hanging out there.
Well, if a claim is not pursued, it is waived, and they certainly had the opportunity, the ability, and, you know, perhaps the desire to raise that claim. If they didn't raise that claim...
You referred to a footnote that they wanted to pursue that claim.
But arguing that you're going to... It's almost... My view is that's worse for them because they recognize that they're not discussing the issue and they're only asking for some possibility of future briefing. They could have raised it at the time. We file an opening brief. They file an opposing brief. If they wanted to oppose it,
they could have opposed it then.
But basically, for us to agree with your position, we would have to find, in the first instance, that these claims were waived.
No, I think you could, if you want to find in my favor, you would find that they don't state a cause of action, and therefore this is not a remedy that would be available in any circumstance.
We would have to do something in the first instance that was never done by the lower court. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that's the entire essence of waiver on appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to just address 3 points. First, this partnership agreement does not completely waive fiduciary duties. The partnership agreement has a contractually defined duty with respect to conflicted transaction, and it is a contractual fiduciary duty that provides that when you're dealing with a contract with affiliate, you can't sell property of the partnership to an affiliate unless the terms are fair and reasonable. And that is a contractually fiduciary duty, and this court has recognized that it's a contractual fiduciary duty way back in Gotham, and Chancellor Stryan has recognized it, and Gatz and other courts have recognized it. This is not a novel proposition, and if the partnership wanted to eliminate fiduciary duties, it could have said so. It doesn't.
I don't know where that gets you, because you still have – you're seeking monetary damages. The agreement makes it clear that there will be no monetary damages absent behavior that constitutes bad faith. So
it gets me. I was going to say the second point that where it gets me, and I apologize for interrupting, Your Honor, is that the defendants have said this is a breach of contract case, and consequently reformation is not available as a remedy. What if this is, as we say, a contractual fiduciary duty case in which there are contractually defined fiduciary duties? I'm talking about the reformation claim.
Reformation classically applies only where there's a divergence between the actual intent of the parties and the intent that was expressed in the writing. How does adding the word equitable before the term reformation change that?
It doesn't. It's a remedy in this circumstances in which there is an exculpation for money damages, and consequently, as a result of the exculpation for money damages, that there's no prohibition against reforming the contract to make the terms fair and reasonable.
But what is there to reform?
What it is is the contractual terms between Enbridge and EEP. The contractual terms right now provide for a sharing arrangement that's.
But that's basically a damages remedy that you're calling equitable reformation, isn't it? You're not really reforming the contract.
We're seeking to have it prospectively performed. But let me address some of the other arguments, because I think the other arguments are. I think that the argument concerning the financial environment in 2009 is an argument about the facts. And I think that that's probably the most important issue here, is that we're at the pleading stage. The standard is reasonably conceivable, and the Vice Chancellor really only mentions that first in his definition of the standard, but he doesn't really in his analysis analyze the complaint and the allegations in the complaint under that standard. The standard is, are there no set of circumstances under which it's reasonably conceivable that the plaintiffs can prove their case? And we believe that this complaint does provide that in clearly. Now, with respect to the multiples, and whether or not the committee should have known about the multiples, it is a reason why in this complaint we went to great detail to describe the other transactions that were presented to the committee. Each one of those other transactions, and there are several paragraphs in the complaint, describes that, one, those transactions were done at market value, not cost, so that a transaction at cost is not the same. Number two, they were all done at higher multiples with an average multiple of 9.3. All of that was information the special committee had, and the special committee had the opportunity to decide, why is this so much lower? It decided, and finally, with respect to the special committee's charge, the special committee's charge was to determine whether the terms of the transaction were fair and reasonable to the partnership. The special committee had no evidence, no information other than the representative opinion from Tudor. It is simply not possible for them to have drawn that conclusion without without insisting on either a fairness opinion or insisting on an opinion that met the terms of the partnership agreement.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.